Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson on his controversial proposal.
I'm making a formal offer to President-elect Trump that inmates from Bristol County and others from across the nation will help build that wall.
The ACLU calls it modern-day slave labor. Sheriff Hodgson will take your calls. Also today, what was Fort Knox's most precious treasure? Wasn't gold. During World War II, it was the United States Constitution.
These documents are so many things. They are artifacts, they are symbols, daily blueprints of how we run our government, how we make our laws.
Plus,
it definitely is the Brady revenge tour. Tom Brady is taking it to Houston. It's Roger Goodell redemption.
The Patriots head to another Super Bowl. We'll talk about it next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
We will make sure that we fight harder, we fight tougher, and we fight more passionately than ever. Not just for the people whom Donald Trump supports, but for all of America.
That's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren on Saturday at the Boston Women's March. Warren has always been a high-profile national figure ever since her election in 2012. However, a new poll from WBUR shows that only 44% of respondents think that Warren deserves re-election, and 46% believe that it's time to, quote, give someone else a chance. So to tell us more about what these numbers mean is Steve Cazella. He's president of the Mass Inc. polling group, who does the polling for WBUR, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Good to be here.
All right. So first of all, this 44% of respondents saying that they think Warren deserves re-election versus 46 saying maybe not. Were you surprised by those numbers?
I was quite surprised. She's never been as popular as, say, Charlie Baker, who especially right after his election had numbers up in the high 60s and even low 70s. You know, she's always been a bit more of a polarizing figure. You know, Republicans have really never liked Elizabeth Warren, and independents have been divided, and, you know, Democrats have been pretty favorable towards her. So, you know, I didn't expect to see her numbers glowing, but still to see them about even was quite surprising to me. Mm.
And just to remind folks, in Massachusetts, most voters who are registered as independents anyway.
Correct. Yes. I mean, Democrats outnumber Republicans by about 3-1. But yes, undeclared or independent voters are the majority.
Right. So when we say give someone else a chance in terms of that 46% saying that, does that mean that those are voters who are disapproving of Warren?
Well, that's the real question, because give someone else a chance could mean a bunch of different things, or at least two distinct different things. It could mean give a different Democrat a chance. You know, some of these, about a third of Democrats said give someone else a chance. And then, or it could mean give a different Republican a chance. And that's, you know, two obviously very different candidates who would have to either come through a primary or come through the general, which then prompts the question of, okay, who exactly are we talking about? You know, there's pretty much only one high-profile person, who Kurt Schilling, that is, who's even speculated about running. And when we polled him specifically last time, we found him trailing by 25. So, you know, this 44-46 split isn't a good one. You know, it's not the numbers you would wish for, but it's not, you know, time to hit the panic button or anything this early.
How far off the norm is it for an incumbent a year or two out from a re-election?
Well, I'd say her favorable numbers are pretty okay. You know, they're about where they have been. You know, she's pretty much climbed to a level and stayed there since her initial election. You know, the even split on the reelect numbers, I think, would be a bit concerning. But again, then you have to get specific and find out who exactly are we talking about running against her.
Well, so let me ask you, since you mentioned favorability, it was 51% favorable in this poll. You also asked that same favorability question of folks and their view of Governor Baker. He had a 59% favorability. So we got a question about that on Facebook. Stephen Lee wrote that Warren and Baker don't have comparable jobs. They don't operate in comparable environments. And given such differences, what does a 59 versus 51 point favorability rating actually mean?
Right. Well, certainly we weren't trying to, you know, pit them against each other or anything. Both favorability and the reelect question are pretty standard poll questions to ask about political office holders. And I think the interesting way to view them is they're de facto leaders of the two parties in Massachusetts. And what was interesting to me is that that although Massachusetts does tend to lean left, does tend to be pretty deep blue on most things, we've had this Republican governor who's been more popular than our Democratic senator, and more popular than our Democratic senator, who's had this huge national profile on in Democratic politics. So they're, again, we're not trying to pit them against each other, but you can use the metrics to sort of compare how warmly the voters feel towards each one of them.
Hmm. Now, finally, Steve, as you know, we just came through a presidential election cycle that left a lot of members of the public with low levels of trust in polling as a whole. So, I mean, what can you say to give listeners confidence in this poll?
Well, I'd say, at the risk of self-endorsement, that our polls have been pretty accurate, both in Massachusetts and elsewhere. The other thing is that one of the big ways that polls missed in this election was in their assessment of who exactly constitutes a likely voter. Mm. Well, we don't have to do that again for a while. Now we're talking about the entire population of registered voters, or in some of the polls you'll be looking at, the whole population of the country. So there's no judgment to be made about how likely people are to vote or not to vote. And that was one of the things which, based on the early indications that we have, seems to have been where a lot of the polls tripped up.
I see. So in this case, you were asking them about their impressions of politicians right now versus
yes,
who they're going to vote for or not.
Exactly.
Well, that's Steve Cazella, president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group, talking about the WBUR poll out today. We've got more information about that at WBUR.org. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, now let's move from politics to sports and that big win last night for the Patriots in Foxborough, sending the team to an NFL record 9th Super Bowl. Joining us now with more is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. She was at the AFC Championship game. Hi, Shira.
Hello.
Still basking in the glow?
I don't know if I am, but I'm sure the Patriots are still at this point.
So you were on the field for the trophy celebration. What was it like?
A little bit surreal. You know, you have those confetti cannons and they're shooting out that blue and red confetti of players wandering around with their families and sort of everybody's hugging. Some people were doing snow angels on the turf, which was a little of an interesting take on things. You have Bon Jovi wandering around with Robert Kraft. I mean, very surreal in many respects. You even had a tight end, Martellus Bennett, taking some time to dance with the cheerleaders, grabbing a pair of pom-poms and doing his own special celebration. And then in the locker room afterwards, he started talking about what he planned to do to continue his celebration into the night, and he said this.
Oh, man, it's pretty cool, man. I don't really know how I feel just yet. I'm super excited. I'm planning on going home, make myself a cake, and I'm going to write "You're awesome" on the cake, and I'm going to sit there and I'll probably eat the whole thing and regret it tomorrow because, you know, I got to make sure I make weight, but that's probably what I'm going to do. I'm going to make your awesome cake for myself and just enjoy it.
You got to love Martellus Bennett.
Your awesome cake?
Yes.
I love that.
He'll be going to the first Super Bowl in his career. It's been a long time coming for him. He'll be going back to his hometown of Houston to play in the Super Bowl. So this is a big deal for him. And he's got his cake. He's going to eat it.
He gets to eat it,
and
too.
He gets to eat it, yes. And, you know, for the record, I believe he was going to do an actual confetti cake with chocolate icing. That was the last word in the locker room.
Well, we should say, though, just get our facts here. The Pats won 36-17,
yes.
Right? Which was quite a change from last week when, against the Texans, they barely eked out their win. A couple weeks ago, Brady threw those two interceptions, got sacked. So, like, what changed between last week and yesterday?
Well, I think first things first, they were looking a little bit past the Houston Texans. Everybody was sort of joking that this was a second bye week because the Houston Texans weren't a very formidable opponent. So I think their focus wasn't quite there. But then when you get to the AFC Championship game, you know what's on the line. Brady was totally dialed in. And then you get those two big touchdowns in the first half and you're kind of rolling. And, you know, Pittsburgh has a major injury to their key running back, Le'Veon Bell. And so all of this sort of culminates in this kind of unstoppable momentum for the Patriots. And once they got off to those two quick scores and got things going. There was no looking back.
Yeah. Okay, so I got to ask you, these aren't my words, but I've been hearing that this may be something of a Brady revenge tour against Commissioner Roger Goodell for that four-game Deflategate suspension.
Yes, I mean, that's certainly how the fans feel. I was spotted in the end zone during the trophy celebration, a firefighter from Lawrence named Graham Miller, and this is what he had to say.
It definitely is the Brady revenge tour. Tom Brady has taken it to Houston. It's Roger Goodell redemption.
Yeah, I think Patriots fans and I would say the organization are not happy with how the whole Deflategate panned out with the four-game suspension that started the season for Brady. And they feel that Brady showing up and potentially winning the Super Bowl and having to face Goodell would be a nice bit of revenge. And, you know, during the game, the fans were shouting, "Where is Roger?"
Oh, dear.
"Where is Roger?" Targeting Goodell because Goodell has not come to a game at Gillette Stadium since Deflategate started, and that happened on the Patriots' last run to the Super Bowl way back in 2015, yeah.
I presume he's going to be at Super Bowl LI, right?
Yes, 51? Super Bowl 51. He will be there, and he may be handing a Super Bowl trophy to Tom Brady. Can we say awkward?
So I just want to reiterate one thing, because when we introduced you, we reminded everyone that this is the Pats' ninth Super Bowl, an NFL record. It's the seventh one for Brady and Bill Belichick, so just a huge accomplishment no matter what happens in a couple of weeks, right?
Yes, I think fans would say that, but I don't think Brady and Belichick would say that. I mean, they are very much focused on getting another title and I think further cementing their grasp on sort of the best dynasty ever. I mean, they really want to outdistance themselves from all of the other dynastic football teams.
So what
NFL.
Do you make of their prospects against Atlanta then?
I think they're pretty good, and I think where they may have the edge, let's put the X's and O's aside, where they may have the edge is the experience that you just talked about, because it is a big game. It can be overwhelming for even the most experienced and most confident players, but Brady has been there, done that, and I think that kind of leadership can really provide a crucial edge.
Wow. Well, WBR Sports Insider reporter Shira Springer talking to us about last night's big win for the Patriots, sending them to their record ninth Super Bowl. Shira, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. As Americans were reeling from the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, four boxes meticulously packaged and inventory left Washington, D.C. on a train with two Secret Service agents, and they headed west. Inside, the founding documents of the United States of America, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and others, documents so precious, President Franklin Roosevelt wanted to guarantee their preservation in the event that Axis powers bombed Washington. Weymouth author Stephen Pulio describes the efforts to safeguard these documents in his latest book, American Treasures, and he joins us now. Stephen, welcome back.
Thanks, Meghna. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. So, first of all, tell us about this train journey. How is it that the United States Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, ended up heading towards where? Fort Knox?
You are correct. So, sure, the United States was very concerned. Roosevelt, Librarian of Congress, Archibald MacLeish, very concerned about these documents being destroyed after Pearl Harbor and after the Germans declare war on the United States. So there's this great effort to move the documents to a safer location. Fort Knox is chosen for the Declaration, for the Constitution, for the Gettysburg Address, and a few other precious documents. But that begins the largest and secret relocation of documents in American history, when about 5,000 boxes are moved to various inland locations over the next several months.
Wow. And so how do they do this? Because, I mean, some of the documents, the Constitution, Declaration, already centuries old.
Absolutely. They were very, very careful about first collecting these documents in the year prior, because there's a great feeling that the country is going to go to war, and then packaging them up and keeping them under lock and key, if you will, for that time when it would be necessary. So the train, as you note, leaves Union Station on December 26th, 1941, the day after America's Pearl Harbor Christmas, and rumbles out to Fort Knox. There's a little space left in the gold bullion depository for just these few precious documents. The rest of the documents are moved at night in secret in the succeeding months by truck to these various locations.
And I understand that they even had to make modifications for the containers that held the documents because they needed to be sure that they stayed dry and things like that?
Yeah, humidity was a big issue. The concern about insects sort of chewing at the documents were big issues. So these things had to be packaged up very, very carefully.
Yeah. Now, we should note that the potential destruction of these documents wasn't an insignificant concern. I mean, Pearl Harbor had happened, and over in Europe, even the Brits had been worried about some of their founding documents and earlier had sent the Magna Carta to the United States?
Yeah, it's what was going on in Europe is what really concerned Roosevelt and Archibald MacLeish. So the Brits lost thousands, hundreds of thousands of documents during the Battle of Britain. They were incinerated, most of them. The Germans were destroying millions of manuscripts, documents in Europe, most by Jewish writers, but also some that were not by Jewish writers. So there's this real worry on Roosevelt's part and MacLeish's part that these documents could be in danger and that that would be devastating to the psyche and the morale of the American people. Mm. And you're right about the Magna Carta. The British had sent it over for the 1939 New York World's Fair. And when war breaks out in Europe, they ask us to hold on to it for safekeeping. That is one of the documents that goes to Fort Knox.
But I understand that we didn't even tell the British that we were moving Magna Carta?
We told them we were moving it, but to a safe spot, not to where we were moving it. Yes.
Wow. Well, I want to know, so you mentioned this fellow MacLeish, and he's very central to this story. Tell us more about him. How did he end up at the Library of Congress?
Yeah, Archibald MacLeish was a poet and a writer. He had left his job as a lawyer to become a full-time writer and a full-time poet. He had written several articles in support of the New Deal, several anti-fascist articles, and Roosevelt really liked him and asked him if he would come on to be a librarian of Congress. Lots of dispute among professional librarians.
Because there's nothing that said he would actually be qualified as a librarian.
Absolutely.
Right?
Never had any experience. But Roosevelt really twisted his arm. MacLeish said no twice to the president. The president finally convinced him to come on board. And this is one of the major projects that he undertakes.
Huh. Now, you wrote that he gave a speech at Faneuil Hall in November 1940 when he talked about I'll just read a little part of it, a little quote from it. In such a time as ours, when wars are made against the spirit and its works, the keeping of these records is itself a kind of warfare. The keepers, whether they so wish it or not, cannot be neutral.
Yeah, MacLeish was a real staunch anti-fascist, and he took umbrage at some of his fellow writers and artists and intellectuals who refused to take a stand against the Nazis. MacLeish just felt like they were shirking their responsibility by staying neutral and not speaking out against Hitler. And he was quite the opposite. It's one of the things that I think attracts him to Roosevelt in the first place. FDR knows war is coming, I think, or at least strongly suspects war is coming. And it's one of the things that bonds those two.
Interesting. Now, there's another Massachusetts connection to this story, a Secret Service agent who was born in Pittsfield, I believe.
Harry Neal is the lead Secret Service agent in this. He's the person who's responsible for taking these documents to Union Station, managing the whole transfer. And yes, he's born in Pittsfield, spends lots of his time in Massachusetts, and then finally gets transferred down to Washington, becomes one of the great Secret Service agents, a legendary Secret Service agent. But he is the man responsible for it and views this activity as one of the most important efforts in his entire career.
Wow. Now, he began, what, as a stenographer and then worked his way up to the Secret Service?
Begins as a stenographer. He's finally asked to go on a mission with the Secret Service agents when they raid a Brooklyn house. And he ends up reaching into a furnace to pull out a counterfeit plate to save it as evidence against these counterfeiters. He becomes the legendary, rookie agent who then works his way up and becomes one of the deputy directors of the Secret Service.
Yeah. Now, just to remind folks that they sent the documents to Fort Knox, which, of course, is legendary, supposedly in its security. So ostensibly it makes sense. But there's also the risk of the journey. I mean, why was that the site they chose? Were there other options that they also looked at for safekeeping of these documents?
So McLeish asks Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, where can we put all of these documents, these 5,000 boxes, in Fort Knox? And Morgenthau says, no, we don't have the room. There's too much gold. There's too much gold bullion stored there. You can have about 60 cubic feet, which is about the size of a freezer. It's a very small amount. So he picks these very few documents, the most important documents. And then the rest of the documents kind of get triaged. Very, very important documents, utterly irreplaceable, essential to American democracy. Things like the president's papers, Washington's diaries, the notes of the Constitutional Convention, the journals of the Continental Congress, all of those. And they're transferred, as I say, under guard by truck to university repositories, all of which they examine about 60 and finally choose three or four. They need to be close enough to D.C. for the Library of Congress staff to inspect them while they're hidden, but far enough away so that German bombers, for example, wouldn't be attracted to that area.
And when did they finally get returned to Washington?
They come back in September of 1944, so about 3 months after D-Day, if you can just put that in your chronological mind, when there's very little concern about an attack on the American mainland at that point. And so they do all come back. The military intelligence says it's okay to bring them back. There is one exception. Earlier, the previous year in April of 1943, at the dedication of the Jefferson Memorial, FDR orders the original copy of the Declaration put on display because he felt that would be a real morale boost to the American people. And it is on display for 1 week. And nobody knows where it came from, and nobody knows where it went back to Fort Knox until it comes out in 44. Yeah.
So all this makes me wonder, do we know what the safety procedures are around these documents today?
We don't. They are secret. The Librarian of Congress, David Ferriero, who was kind enough to blurb this book and be part of this project from the beginning, during my interview with him, I asked him that very question, and he said, no, it's a big part of the security plan, and one of the biggest part of the security plan is not talking about the security plan. So since 9/11, that's really, really become secret.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're living in the modern age where, of course, there are very detailed digital copies and scans of most, not all of these documents, but definitely the Constitution, the Declaration, the big named ones that are publicly available. We can look it up right now on the internet. So in terms of what they look like and the information on them, one would hope that no matter what happens, we'll have that information in perpetuity. So why do you think it continues? It stays important to preserve the original documents themselves.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And as you may know, a million people file through the National Archives Rotunda every year to see these documents. And I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one, people kind of recognize that we are a constitutional republic that can trace our founding back to a single document, the Declaration of Independence. That's one. And two, these documents are living documents today. I mean, the whole underpinning of our philosophy is in the Declaration, and the Constitution is with us every day. Every time you hear a newscaster say, you know, does Congress have enough votes to override a presidential veto? Who will control the Senate in the next election? You know, what will the Supreme Court say about the constitutionality of this law? You're talking about the United States Constitution. So I think people kind of get that feeling that these documents are precious. They are part of our heritage. I had a very perceptive editor say to me one time, America has no crown jewels, but if it did, it would be these documents. And I think people recognize that when they see it at the Rotunda.
Yeah, direct connection.
Absolutely.
With that history and all that it means. Well, Stephen Pulio is author of American Treasures, The Secret Efforts to Save the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Gettysburg Address. He'll be speaking about his book at the Boston Public Library on February 1st, I believe, right?
That's right.
We've got more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Stephen, thank you so much for sharing this story, and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Megan. Thank you.
Well, as you've probably heard, a nor'easter is coming this evening and bringing lots of high winds and rain to Massachusetts. So let's get an update on the storm from WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. And he joins us now via Skype. Hi there, David.
Good afternoon, Meghna.
So I've been seeing some stuff falling out of the sky. What's your forecast right now?
Well, right now we're looking at the the heaviest stuff moving in after the evening commute. So although there has been indeed some light precipitation, snow, sleet, spotty, the real line of the heavy precipitation runs right now through about Bridgeport and the center part of Rhode Island. And that's going to take another 3 to 4 hours to get into the Boston area.
Okay. And so by the time it makes it up here, even great news to hear that it'll probably be after the evening commute. What's it going to look like? Is it going to be snow, sleet, rain?
Yes, it will be. and that is the tricky part of this forecast, is that it is going to be snow, sleet, rain. And exactly the exact temperature profile of the atmosphere from where one is standing going up to where the stuff is falling out of the clouds will be critical as to what people get. So we do know that from Boston south and east, it's going to be rain, maybe mixed with a few sleet pellets. As you get out to the 128 belt, rain and sleet mix. But then as you get west of 495, say on a line from about Worcester on to say Manchester and back through Sanford, Maine, that's where there's going to be a lot of sleet mixed in with this system. And there could be a coating up to 3 or 4 inches, maybe 5 in the highest elevations of a snow sleet mixture. And sleet's very dense, very heavy. If you do see it sleeting hour after hour, it takes a while to move it around. You're going to want to do it little by little.
Yeah. And when do you think this nor'easter is likely to come to an end?
So during the day tomorrow, we are still expecting rain, especially heavy in the morning. Even if folks get sleet tonight, I think that it will be changing to rain tomorrow morning. And then during the day, we'll still have periods of rain. It ends tomorrow night. As we get for Wednesday, we'll look for clearing skies. Believe it or not, 45 to 50 Wednesday afternoon. And really, that's been the story this winter. We get these storms that have some wintry precipitation, but we quickly warm up after they leave.
Yeah. And David, one last quick question. Is the total amount of precipitation we're likely to get going to have any kind of impact on the drought that Massachusetts has been having?
Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely. So the answer is yes, it will, because we're going to see anywhere from 1 to 2 inches, maybe a little more, but generally 1 to 2 inches of precipitation, even when the sleet melts, that would it melt down to. And that will have an effect. It's not going to erase it, though. We're still behind, and this will only bring us up towards about what you'd expect in terms of precipitation for January. We still need months with 5 or 6 inches of rain or equivalent liquid to really get out of this drought. We just haven't seen that yet.
Well, that's WBUR meteorologist David Epstein giving us an update on the nor'easter that's coming through. I think the good news, David, is that it's likely to come in after the evening commute. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I want to take a minute to introduce a new project we're doing. We're calling it the Citizenship Project. And here's why. Because, you know, presidents often talk about their definitions of citizenship in their inaugural addresses, and we've got some examples.
At the bedrock of our politics will be a total allegiance to the United States of America. And through our loyalty to our country, we will rediscover our loyalty to each other.
I ask you to be citizens. Citizens, not spectators. Citizens, not subjects. Responsible citizens building communities of service and a nation of character.
But those values upon which our success depends, honesty and hard work, courage and fair play, tolerance and curiosity, loyalty and patriotism, these things are old. These things are true.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
You just heard John F. Kennedy in 1961, Barack Obama in 2009, George W. Bush in 2001, and Donald J. Trump in 2017. But we wanted to know, what does citizenship mean today to you? So that's why we're asking you to participate online or on the radio. All you've got to do is take a picture of yourself and then post it on social media with a caption that has your name, age, and where you're from, and then what citizenship means to you. Use the hashtag citizenshipmeans, and you can also make a voice memo on your phone and send it to us. We've got directions on how to do all of this at wbur.fm/citizenshipproject. And if you go there right now, you can see how I tried to get things started with my personal definition of citizenship, which, by the way, borrows a line from Frederick Douglass. It's from a speech he gave in Boston in 1869, where he was defending the citizenship rights of Chinese immigrants. And he said, "The outspread wings of the American eagle are broad enough to shelter all who are likely to come." Now, maybe you agree or disagree, but that's the goal of the Citizenship Project. Everyone has their own concept of citizenship, and we're running the project all year long with the hope that, as you submit your thoughts and ideas, we'll start to see just how dynamic the 2017 definition of citizenship can be. So please do be a part of Radio Boston's Citizenship Project. Again, for more information on how to do that, go to wbur.fm/citizenshipproject. Okay, now let's move on to our next guest. He's Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson, and he joins us now. He's been making headlines lately for a proposed national program to use inmates to help build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, a campaign promise, of course, of President Donald Trump. Now, Hodgson calls the program Project NICE, short for National Inmates Community Endeavors. He says inmates could also be used to respond to natural disasters or other public works projects. It's a controversial idea, though, and it drew immediate criticism. Carol Rose, executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts, called it, quote, modern-day slave labor. And Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson joins us now. Welcome to the show, Sheriff.
Thanks for having me, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing well. And by the way, listeners, we want to know what you think of Sheriff Hodgson's plans. Do you agree? Are you skeptical? Where do you draw the line between what is and isn't acceptable labor for prison inmates? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, so Sheriff Hodgson, just kick us off here. Describe it in your own words. What would Project NICE do?
Well, first of all, it would allow inmates who, by the way, would volunteer for the project to be involved in this instance, as you were speaking about the wall, from around the country. Inmates would respond to that infrastructure project and provide the free labor that taxpayers otherwise would have to pay for, and at the same time give them the opportunity to be involved in a chance to begin rehabilitating themselves through creating a work ethic as to preparing for reentry and get on a trajectory where they can have something on their resume that they've done good for the country, and also as I say, use as a reference for their opportunity to get jobs. Keep in mind, too, that the wall that they would be building would actually prevent people from illegally entering the country and taking jobs that they otherwise themselves might be able to apply for when they get released.
Sheriff, if I might just jump in here, because I've got a couple follow-up questions here.
Sure.
You're saying they're providing free labor to build a wall. First and foremost, I mean, respond to what the ACLU of Massachusetts says, that, you know, that's basically equivalent to a modern-day version of slave labor.
Look, First of all, there's two points to that. Number one, I don't know anybody in our history that volunteered to be slaves. So their premise is absolutely ridiculous in that regard. Secondly, if you want to talk about slave labor, how about the ACLU talking about the fact that these people who are coming in here illegally are being used in a form of modern day slavery, because they're being hired by companies illegally to undercut legitimate companies who otherwise would be getting work for legal residents and for American citizens, and frankly, putting these people in these positions of sometimes hard labor with no medical coverage. When they get hurt, they're dropped off at emergency rooms and maybe never able to work ever again in their lives. So if the ACLU wants to talk about real legitimate modern-day slavery, they ought to be talking about how people who are coming in here illegally are being used by people.
Well, the two aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. But I also want to ask you, I mean, if you're using inmate labor to help build the wall in the hopes of, like, saving jobs for American workers, aren't those inmates themselves taking jobs? That, I mean, like, there are qualified construction workers who, you know, maybe would want the American construction workers who'd want the job to build the wall, but instead you're offering free labor from inmates.
Well, that's a great point. Actually, sheriff's offices all over the country are doing this kind of work in their communities, and we're not competing with unions or anyone else who could legitimately get jobs. They may be simply responsible for doing, carrying supplies or doing things that otherwise wouldn't be available for people that otherwise might do them either legally as citizens or as unions. So we've never had that issue, and sheriffs across this country have been saving billions and billions of dollars in their counties for years and years and years. And we don't compete with unions, and we don't take jobs away from people who are hardworking, you know, legal residents or U.S. citizens.
Now, Sheriff, when you first started talking about Project Nice, you also added that it might be used for assistance in natural disasters, things like that. But you really focused on this wall. And that's why another member of the Massachusetts ACLU said, because of that, they don't see this as a rehabilitative program whatsoever. That by focusing on the wall and saying you're going to send Massachusetts incarcerated people to the U.S.-Mexico border, that this is all about politics. Isn't it?
Well, actually, it's not. We were involved in the relief effort for Haiti. We didn't send our inmates to Haiti, but we set up a relief operation at our facility and sent a tractor trailer load of supplies over that the inmates participated in by folding clothes every day, sorting toys, and putting them in military transport boxes, knowing that they were involved in a national relief effort. So this is an initiative that didn't start with the wall. This is something that started going back probably almost over 3 years ago. I started this national initiative, talking to national sheriffs about the idea that we need to do this to help get communities back on their feet, to help infrastructure projects, whether it could be assisting with the laying of pipes in Flint, Michigan, where they've had that contamination problem and the resources haven't been available to get that job done. So it really is not, this is not about politics. This is about doing something good for America, any more than, for example, if you looked at what happened on 9/11. We didn't say to New York, hey, listen, you were attacked in New York, and that's your problem. It was on your territory. People from, not only from all over the country, but all over the world, from all different walks of public safety, came forward because it was bigger than just something happening in some city or some county. It was something that affected all of America.
Yeah, point taken. But you're offering the labor of incarcerated people who, I mean, you're saying that they have the option, but do they really? I mean, they're in prison. They don't really have a choice. If the sheriff says, hey, there's this program, we want you to participate, aren't they going to do it?
No, they're not. We have a lot of people that don't participate all over the country for sheriffs in their various cities and towns. In fact, I was on a show years ago with Johnny Cochran's show, and we had an inmate, Amnesty International, myself. And before I could answer the complaints of the Amnesty International, the inmate jumped in and said, who is this guy to tell me that I have no right to go out and do good things for people? I like volunteering and going out, and it's helping me. I'm getting no thank you sitting in a cell in my unit all day when I can go out and do something, develop a work ethic, and feel that I'm doing something good. Mm. So these inmates, look, they want to go out and do good things. We've had them build ball fields. We put them on a boat and sent them out to the Butler Flats Lighthouse in New Bedford for 2 summers. They refurbished a national historic landmark out there. So look, they're feeling good. And one of the, when we built the handicapped accessible treehouse, one of the inmates at the end said, you know, I'm convinced that God sent me here, so I sent me back to jail so I could do this project. The other guy on the lighthouse said, I'm going to be able to come down here when I get released and point out to that lighthouse and tell my son that I had something to do with rehabbing this historic landmark. So, you know, these are individuals that want to get back into society and do something good. It's, if you push the politics aside, this is really the biggest objections, really, you started out by saying this, if it were Hillary Clinton's, and she were the one that were elected, and it was Hillary Clinton's beautification National Garden somewhere, nobody would say a word. But it really has a lot to do with the fact that there are many people who resisted the election. There are people that don't like the idea of a wall. And I understand that and respect that. But this isn't about, if you take that away and you simply look at a project for the taxpayers, for the inmates to be rehabilitated, it's a great opportunity and a great win-win for everyone.
Well, I think there is a variety of opinion on that. We are speaking with Sheriff Thomas Hodgson. He's sheriff of Bristol County. He's talking to us about his proposal called Project NICE. That's short for National Inmates Community Endeavors. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And Sheriff, I've got some people who have some questions for you, so I'm going to turn to the phones here. Mallory is calling from Dorchester. You're on the air, Mallory.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. First, I wanted to say I fundamentally disagree with the project of building a wall. And also, I think what would better serve Massachusetts communities is alternative sentencing at the district level. The sheriff is talking about people who are in a county jail doing sentences of less than 2.5 years. And instead of sitting in jail or instead of building a racist wall, we could have alternative sentences where those people are home in their communities with their families, working jobs that are being paid more than cents an hour, that are getting drug treatment and mental health treatment that they need, again, rather than participating in this racist project. I think that would be much better for Massachusetts communities and Bristol County. And also, as a side note, I wanted to mention that immigrants are not taking formerly incarcerated people's jobs. Formerly incarcerated people are struggling to find work because of their quarries, and that's an issue that we need to address as well.
Mallory, thank you so much for your call. Sheriff Hodgson, responds to that.
Sure. Well, let me start with the continued efforts by people like the caller who simply and often leave out the word illegal. I didn't say immigrant. I said illegal immigrant. There's a big difference between the two, number one. Number two, it's not a racist initiative. It never has been. We've been doing it, these projects throughout our county, as have sheriffs across the country. And thirdly, look, again,
can I just jump in here? I think people, just to clarify, I think one of the reasons why people say or believe that it's a racist initiative is because, not so much for the initiative itself, but because of the criminal justice system, that we know that people of color, immigrants, those folks in lower, who are lower on the socioeconomic scale, that they are disproportionately impacted and become incarcerated or sent to jail. That, and so therefore, the people most likely, say your program went national, to have to participate in it, are those who are in jail, and you're looking at a lot of people of color.
Well, actually, I started tandem work crews in my county, which are people that are on a restraint, and we had very few people of color on our.
Folks called that program a chain gang.
Well, they can call it what they want, but let me tell you something. Management. There are management training courses where they tether executives together to see how well they do. And we actually had an inmate in one of the crews when a state representative went out there, and she asked all of them, do you enjoy doing this? Did you volunteer? Absolutely, ma'am. We want to do this. And one of the guys in the middle said, why did you volunteer? He said, I have to tell you something. I'm in the middle of this group of five people, and I have anger management problems. This helps me to be able to work with people and accomplish tasks, and I have to learn how to cooperate with others. And these people have built, the tandem crews painted the inside of every senior living complex in the city of Taunton. The seniors were baking them cookies. The inmates were asking them to help carry their groceries in while they were working there. This was an opportunity for them to get exposed to things that they will hopefully get exposed to when they get out, where they're, many of them never had grandma and grandpa types. And I would tell you, It gives them the confidence that, look, you are valuable. You can do something good. And when you get out, you know, we think you're worth something. So
point taken. But I suppose people wondered why they had to be chained together in order to help make that point. But let me turn to another call on this issue of what inmates might you say inmates learn from these programs, because Benjamin's on the line from Worcester. You're on the air, Benjamin.
Thank you for taking my call. I want the sheriff to understand that these people need education, nothing else. Building war is not his business. Give them education. It's correction agency and nothing else. Give them education.
Benjamin, we take your point. Thank you so much for your call, Sheriff Hodgson.
I have one of the highest GED graduation rates in the state with my inmates. So we have all these programs, but not everyone necessarily needs a GED. Not everyone has a substance abuse program, and the ones that are going out there are doing it because they want to go out there, and they do have access to these other programs. So, and the other thing you made a mention before the caller called in about why would they be in restraints. We have people that go out who do not have restraints because they're in the last 6 months of their sentence. We have so much work that we offered it to the next level, saying if you go out, the only way you can go out because you have a longer period of time, and my responsibility, of course, is to make sure I protect the public safety, that you'll have the opportunity, but you have to go on a restraint. They have all volunteered to do it, and they've done a great job out there.
Hmm. Now, by the way, Sheriff, you mentioned other projects that inmate crews have done. There was some work in Attleboro that was, at the time, it was $250,000 worth of work and at least another $1 million worth of painting and other work by inmates, done by inmates at an elderly housing complex in Taunton. This was several years ago. I'm just curious, when we say that much worth of work, is that how much money is actually being charged? I mean, what happens to the money?
Oh, no. Okay. Money that's saved. And for example, the North Attleboro Police Station, they renovated a factory, and they went in, and they saved, I think it was actually $350,000. The chief of police was there every day talking with the inmates. They're buying them pizzas for the work they were doing. But no, that million, the $350,000 was the savings to the town of North Attleboro for the work that the inmates were doing in there that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to get done because of their funding caps. So these are the kinds of things that they do for not-for-profits and for government agencies.
Okay, I want to sneak in a couple more calls here before we run down on time too much. Angie's calling from Framingham. You're on the air, Angie.
Angie?
Yes, Angie, are you on?
I think it's Nancy in Framingham. Hi. I want to say that walls are built out of fear, and they're eventually breached, including the Great Wall of China.
Nancy, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to just move on. I want to get as many people as I can on the air today. But Nancy, thank you so much. Let's turn to Richard, who's calling from Truro. You're on the air, Richard.
Hi. Yeah, I think that this is not the same as wrapping bandages for building a library. This is building the proposal by a fascist president to build something to oppress people in Mexico. I mean, the whole thing is so fraught with symbolism. This country should have nothing to do with it. I'm ashamed that anyone from Massachusetts, especially an elected official, would sign on to this. It's disgraceful. I mean, if you want to have your inmates do things for the public good, find ones that aren't controversial. Find ones that really are positive and beneficial.
Richard, I'm going to take it back from you so I can let the sheriff respond. Thank you so much for your call. I noticed
Richard didn't say anything about the wall that Mexico built along the border of Guatemala as a problem. Here's the issue. My job is public safety. I've been working on immigration reform since 1998. I've seen the tragedies in two people killed in Milford by illegals coming through. We just saw a young girl, who was murdered by her father. He'd returned to this country twice. Look, we have laws in this country, and if there are people that don't like the laws, look, there's not, the wall is not to say nobody's going to be able to immigrate to the United States. There's 5 million people around the world respecting the laws of the United States, waiting their turn. We can't create a special class of people that we say, don't worry about waiting like the rest of the people who are following our laws. Come on in, and we'll create a special class of people and allow you to sneak in here and try to get a job illegally and create, in some instances, tragedy for families and for our
communities. But Sheriff Hodgson, let me just jump in here because I take your point. But once again, I mean, we had this same problem during the actual election that folks seem to be conflating things between the actual number of undocumented immigrants who are in the United States and the diminishingly small percentage of them who are committing crimes. I mean, when you lump all that in together, it makes it very difficult to actually have a clear-minded conversation about, you know, whether what the wall is actually supposed to accomplish.
No, the wall is supposed to accomplish not just the fact that people are committing crimes. Look, you cannot argue the point that we can create a special class of people in the United States, that we're going to look the other way, allow them to come in. We have terrorists who are coming across that border. We don't know who they are. You may say this person hasn't done anything wrong, as people probably would have said about Muhammad Atta and his buddies that hit the World Trade Center, about the Tsarnaev brothers, because they hadn't done anything wrong at that point.
But all came in legally, too.
They did, but we have a lot of people who are coming in illegally who are also involved in terrorist activity. So what I'm saying, my point is not that they came in legally, but that we don't know who's coming in. And people are sneaking in here, and we can't have that. We know the terrorists are coming across through the drug cartels' pathways. They've already caught people on the border who are known terrorists. So, look, our job, first and foremost, as Americans, is to uphold laws. People that say, well, these poor people coming through, where do the kids in Chicago run? Where do they run? Do they run to Mexico? Mm-hmm. I mean, we have laws here. People need to follow them. We can't say, well, you know, this person's running from a gang. You know how many gangs have come through that now are established in California and Chicago and other places?
Sheriff Hodgson, I've got to jump in here again. I'm sorry, because I keep sounding like I'm interrupting you, and I'm only doing that because I'm always looking at the clock and mindful of the time. And I want to say that I'm really grateful that that you made the time for us. We have less than 30 seconds here to go, but I'm just curious. I mean, you made the offer a couple of weeks ago, kind of broadly, to he was then president-elect. Now, has now President Trump responded to your plan?
We've not had a response at all, and they may not feel that it's something that they want to take advantage of, and that's fine. We're still going to continue with our national initiative around the country, and we're going to do everything we can to offer it to people. And I'll be at the National Sheriff's Conference in about this coming month, and I'll be talking more about it with other sheriffs who are very excited about it.
Well, that's Sheriff Thomas Hodgson. He's sheriff of Bristol County. He joined us today on the line to talk about his Project NICE. Sheriff Hodgson, thank you so much for your time, and thank you
Thanks
for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Take care. Bye.
And listeners, we know you have a lot of thoughts about this, so go to our website, radioboston.org. There's a comment section there. Put your comments in or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.